September 1989 oder 1989 in der Sprache zu bleiben. Und er wird uns jetzt ein Video geben mit einem leichten Titel im Vergleich zum Programm Urban Access for the Typing in the Social Sciences and Humanities.
Ich werde jetzt einen Vortrag halten für die Nicht-Österreicher, in dem ich ins Englische wechsle, wenn ich darf. Der Grund ist, dass ich im Laufe meiner Karriere viele Jahre im Ausland war, die Arbeitssprache immer Englisch war. Da ich jetzt in Berlin zurück bin, für die Max-Planck-Gesellschaft arbeite, aber in unserem Büro die Arbeitssprache schon wieder Englisch ist. Und ich mich einfach von der Terminologie und dem, was ich sagen möchte, sicherer fühle, wenn ich es auf Englisch mache. Weil ich immer das Gefühl habe, wenn ich es auf Deutsch mache, dann denken meine Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer, dass ich wahrscheinlich keinen Schulabschluss habe, weil mir das irgendwie so ungenau vorkommt. Okay, so I'll switch into English to please those who are non-Austrians. I, as you can see, I've sort of slightly changed the title. This comes from you see a conference announcement, you get in touch, then finally you hear something back, then you realize how long you've actually got, you also realize what else is coming, and you try to adapt. So I've tried to adapt it, and I will speak a bit broader today about open access in the social sciences and humanities, and also introduce you to some new information or stuff that I'm doing with and for the Max Planck Society. And of course, this is one of the benefits of open access, because I can tell you that if you were, so to speak, interested in the exact details of the abstract that I first sent to Usha, there's no problem, because the full paper obviously is available in open access on the internet. So there's no problem if you want to have a look at it, read it, download it, do whatever, and there's more publications available. Because I, as you can see at the bottom line, I actually use an author page on which all publications are available in open access. And what I conventionally do is, once I have it ready in sort of a working paper status, and I think that it no longer embarrasses me, I upload it to the Social Science Research Network and post it there, which, by the way, also takes care of this problem with the publishers of whether they permit open access this, that, or not. Because you just put it up as a working paper before you ever submitted it to a journal source out there on their own, and I've never met a publisher who then actually asks you to take it down. So it somehow takes care of it takes care of the problem. Okay, by way of introduction, also this will become clear in the presentation later in some of the things I refer to. I have sort of a double function. So on the one hand, as I said, my salary comes from the Max Planck Society in Germany, and I work in the field of open access and scholarly communication for them. But I'm also one of the co-founders of something called the Research Network 1989. This is a network that is broadly devoted to the causes and consequences of 1989, the year, the revolutions, the non-revolution in China, the end of the Cold War, the downfall of communism, the way the global economy has changed since then, these kinds of questions that are really broadly seen. A specific characteristic of this research network is probably that most of its members have a distinctly international biography. I'm maybe quite typical of this. I did my undergraduate studies in Germany, but then while doing my PhD afterwards, I spent 2 years in Poland, 1 year in Siberia, 7 months in Hungary, 2 years in Italy, and I think 5 or 6 years altogether in the UK. So I've just sort of been around. And a lot of people who are active in the research network have the same kind of east-west biography. So they might be from the east and have spent a lot of time in the west, or are living in the west, or moved back to the east, or the other way around. Westerners moved me to Eastern Europe quite a bit. And somehow pursue an academic career. The typical member of the research network 1989 is a postdoc. So someone who's got a PhD, but is in a postdoc position or on junior faculty, tenure track, or whatever. Professors only, we only have on the Marx report. So we're also distinctly a younger set of people. Okay. Within the Max Planck Society, I have like three jobs that I'm supposed to do. One is to participate, obviously not alone, but together to make open access happen, to kind of implement and move it forward. This is within the framework of the Berlin Declaration, obviously. Maybe since the Berlin Declaration has come up, I think one of the things that is distinctive about the Berlin Declaration is that it isn't bottom-up, but that it is institutional. And that was always the way it was meant to be, and those people inside the Max Planck Society who drafted it were very well aware that what they needed was the signatures of the heads of the institutions. So the Berlin Declaration can't really be signed by anybody, but usually only by the president or the equivalent. And that was done on purpose. To have certain kinds of effects, and in terms of the effectiveness of the whole idea and getting things moving. Okay, the other thing I do is I work on scholarly communication. I'll come onto this European Observatory on Publishing Preservation and Access in a minute. It's connected to European projects that we are running. And my third task is, so to speak, to be reflexive. This has to do with my background, which I said I'm a sociologist. I'm a sociologist in two senses. On the one hand, I'm a historical sociologist, that's the research network 1989, but on the other hand, my undergraduate degree actually was in science and technology studies. So I come out with a social science perspective that deals with science and technology, its changes and the way things work. And this is also in the background of qualification here for the There's an interface between what I do for the Max Planck Society and the Research Network 1989, and that revolves, of course, around things digital and open access publishing. Okay. So the first bit of information I've brought along is something for which you will see press release next week. In this sense, I'm probably relatively safe in talking about it. I'm talking about a multi-year, multi-billion euro project funded by the European Commission and the project partners that is called Publishing and the Ecology of European Research, PEER. The distinctive thing about this project is that there's going to be a large-scale archiving of so-called Stage 2 manuscripts. The Stage 2 manuscript is the final peer-reviewed author's version of the article. So this is not the working paper, and it's not the post-publication print. It's at Stage 2, after peer review, before the publisher publishes it, actually, somewhere. Okay. The participants in this peer project are STM. This is the Association of Publishers in Science, Technology, and Medicine, and they participate on behalf and in coordinating several of, or most of, the large publishers in the world. So Elsevier is in there, Wiley Blackwell is in there, Springer is in there, obviously, Oxford University Press you will find, and so on. So these are all part of the consortium. Then representing the community of research funders and research organizations, you have the European Science Foundation involved. Then involved, so to speak, on behalf of the libraries and repositories, you have Göttingen and this Driver Network, which some of you might have heard of. This is this network of European repositories that's being built up, so the infrastructure of institutional repositories. The Max Planck Society, which contributes to the projects on various levels. One is we have a repository. Two is we're obviously also a research organization and a research funder. And three, we do this Europa, i.e. this European Research Observatory for Public Preservation and Access. And what does that do? It is concerned with looking at issues of usage, behavior, economics, when you are dealing with a large-scale project in which publishers and repositories and which is about the large-scale archiving of these manuscripts. So what's going on here? What's going on is that the publishers have said, you know, principally, actually, we don't like open access. But we realize there are a lot of people out there who like it, and we also realize there are some quite powerful players that have passed open access mandates. And somehow we need to live with it, or we need to find out whether we can live with it and or what the consequences are. So we would consent to doing a large-scale experiment that revolves around archiving these manuscripts, and we would also to some extent co-finance this. Maybe it's important to note that even though it's a multi-million euro budget and it's financed by the European Union, it's 50% co-financed by the partners in the French project. So only half of the money comes out of the European Union, the other half is contributed by the project partners, which also means that the publishers are investing a substantial amount of money into this. So the publishers have said, let us take several hundred journals, and from these journals we will take the manuscripts and we will, so to speak, give them permission to self-archive. So we have two sets of journals corresponding. We have a set of journals that the publishers have selected for this self-archiving process, this experiment, and they're going to have an equal set of journals, an equivalent set of journals where this self-archiving, they are not participating in the experiment. So if you so like, you have a control group, yeah? You can observe 200 journals that are in the experiment and 200 journals that are outside the experiment, and you can, for example, observe them in terms of usage. Now, usage is, say, downloads, yeah? The way they're being accessed, how often they're being downloaded. Then within those journals that are participating in the project, you distinguish between papers that have European lead authors and papers that don't have. So within the experiment, within the set of 200 journals, only those papers will get archived where you have a European author or at least a European lead author. If that is not the case, the paper doesn't participate. So within each journal you have between Europe and non-European, also has something to do with the funding or not. But then it continues further in the sense that we have about 60,000 articles or so that become, or possibly more, that become eligible for archiving every year, this stage 2 manuscript. The thing is that half of these will be deposited in the archives directly by the publisher. So this isn't self-archiving, this isn't even assisted archiving, let your library help you do it. This is publisher-initiated archiving, where there's a workflow directly from the publisher to the repository. End of story. That's for half. For the other half, some sort of self-archiving is supposed to take place. This is actually still under discussion and it's not quite clear exactly how it's going to work. It'll be some sort of genuine self-archiving or some version of assisted archiving. The author gets an email saying, do you want this self-archived? Can you do it yourself? If no, press this button and the librarian will help you to do it or something like this. So it's a relatively complex way with large numbers in which it's being tested what is going on there. My particular job there is connected to this Europa, i.e. to look at usage, so we're looking at usage for the journals. This means the publishers are granted access to their log files, we can see what actually happens on their site. We'll be looking at the log files of the repositories, obviously, various types of repositories, so we'll be looking at that. Another part of it is the behavior. That revolves around what authors and users do think, and whether their behavior and attitudes in any way change during the duration of the experiment. This, of course, crucial to the experiment is the fact that we know all the authors whose manuscripts are being deposited. Right? So we know who it is, we have an address, and we have an email. So there are things you can follow up in terms of behaviors and attitudes. And this is quite large scale. And the final point, the economics, is about, so if you do this kind of process, and we're talking that we want more open access and we want it through this green road, through some form of archiving of stage 2 manuscript, what's the cost involved? How can you do this? What does it cost you? And how can you do it efficiently once the numbers really go up? Okay. So, the press release for this should be out next week, so this is, I think, more or less out in the open. And you'll be hearing more about this. This is the second one, which is under negotiation. So I have to say that the European Commission has come back on a proposal that we put in and said, yes, we're interested. Yes, in principle, we would like to fund you, but now we need to negotiate the contract. So what I'm telling you now might just be a nice idea. We might never sign that contract. Brackets open, yeah, what I'm saying is completely temporary, and I can say it in this room, but I can't say it on the other, okay? It's another kind of consortium, also includes publishers, but it does something else. Instead of looking at the green road, it looks only at the golden road. The consortium here consists actually of your usual suspects. So CERN is inside, the Max Planck Society is part of it, STFC, Science and Technology Facilities Council, part of Research Council UK. And then from the publishers you have Sage, Springer, and BioNTech. Sage is in because they have recently teamed up with a publisher called Hindawi to launch a fleet of open access journals. Footnote, only in the natural sciences. There's no intention, but on behalf of Sage, fifth largest publisher in the world, in principle with a large collection in the social sciences and humanities, but when it comes to these open access journals, there's no intention at this point in time to do anything in the social sciences or humanities. It's more a question of wanting to of the natural sciences. Okay, what we're trying to do here, or what the project idea revolves around, and if it were to kick off, if we get that punch act, and if it were to kick off sometime next spring, what we'd be looking at is we'd be looking at a variety of open access publishing models. I'll come back to that a little later, maybe in more detail. But you might have noticed, or if not, I'm telling you now, that in terms of open access publishing, things have changed a little. So there's a way in which open access publishing often comes as author's pays, right? Total access is the reader pays and it's free for the author. Open access is it's free for the reader but the author must pay. Okay, and this is of course indeed how it often works. And we've just had it this morning with FWF, where they pay, so to speak, a publication. But there are a number of open access models emerging which revolve around open access publishing, which do not assume that the author pays. So one of the things I think what FWF is also inadvertently moving to a form of institutional subscription. So the Max Planck Society, for example, has this with Springer. For every paper that the Max Planck author publishes in the Springer journal, it's not the author that pays a fee, but Springer comes to the Max Planck Society, Max Planck pays a fee, Springer publishes in open access and pushes out the publisher's PDF back to the Max Planck Society. So we have it, so to speak, on record. Another one you might have heard of is, that's why CERN is on board in this project, is Scope 3. That's a consortium for open access publishing in particle physics. That revolves around collecting money from the institutions that are strong in particle in this kind of research, particle physics, from their libraries or from their research budgets or whatever, and kind of forming a sponsoring consortium that then does a tender. So you have a certain well delineated research field for which you can more or less describe what it consists of and also what might be relevant journals. You collect the money beforehand and you do a tender. You do a public tender that says, we want X amount of peer review articles published per year and we're willing to give you X amount of money for it. Who's going to take it? And you get a different kind of dynamic in terms of the publication market. The second part of the project is going to be, if it works out, a relatively large scale survey that will look specifically at authors and will try and find out in what ways they're willing to move towards open access, what they might be willing to trade in that transition to open access and what not. This issue is raised earlier today, journal impact factors, for example. Yeah? I mean, how high a barrier is that? When does it stop being a barrier? Are there alternative ways of doing it? For example, if open access publishing were to mean that we can put precise metrics on each individual article, does the journal impact factor become a lower barrier to pass? These kinds of questions. Okay. I was going to switch around and talk about the research trip of 1989. I've actually brought something with me that I was going to pass around. I have a number of copies. I'll pass some right and left. And I gather that since I have a very informed audience today, you might be able to help me with this. So on the one hand, I do things for the Max Planck Society, but on the other hand, we're also doing this with the research. It's relatively lengthy, so I'll be talking longer, so I'm assuming you can have a quick glance through, pass it on, and if anybody's interested to talk more to me, we can do that later over lunch or whatever. But I wanted to bring it with me because I thought it might be interesting because it brought out the question, is it feasible to launch a journal in open access in the social sciences and humanities that is fee-based, that charges some sort of publication? Now the issue is, as you might be well aware, that open access journals in the social sciences and humanities, of course, exist. They do exist. But the typical form they take is that somebody, some researcher, some professor or whatever, more or less manages the journal from his or her desktop. Yeah, this relatively widespread phenomenon, which you all agree. The other one that has a bit more substantial and has higher chances of longevity is that an institution steps in, and that the journal is more or less run through the institution. The institution is the office space, maybe takes the editor, or one of the social sciences and humanities, also gives the web space, does the maintenance of the website, and therefore you can publish an open access. Now, these are might be viable open access models, but we were thinking, what happens if you try and launch a new journal in the social sciences and humanities, and you do it together with a professional publisher who would need, I don't know, 1,000 euros per article, and do you get the added benefit that you really would have a professional publishing house with all the benefits that this brings? Yeah, you can organize the peer review to a guaranteed higher quality standard. You can do the editing of the articles. You can also, if it's English, with English language correction, so on and so on. You can, so to speak, push it to a higher standard. And I brought this proposal with me. There's maybe three things I would like to mention. One is, we looked at this, and we also looked at this in terms of what would we need to do if we launch a new journal to achieve some sort of visibility and impact relatively early on. What do we need to do? And we figured that maybe a way of going about this was to do some sort of strategic compromises. So we know from studies about journal impact factors, citations, and so on, we know that certain kinds of articles get cited more. They have it doesn't mean they're higher quality, it just means they have more impact in terms of more citations. Okay. There are two candidates for this, review articles and method articles. So if you start a new journal, we figured you need to have those sections in there. You need to explicitly put them in. And you need to go and find people who can write you those review and method articles that deliver that kind of impact. The other thing that we figured in terms of getting more widely known, and it may be important for the social science and humanities, is that you need to have a policy section. This is about reaching, so to speak, the world with politics and policy is made, and maybe finding users would be interesting. The second issue I wanted to raise is, why would you go away with the social science and humanities journal? I mean, what kind of sense does it make, given the fact that actually the first reaction you get when you say you want to go with an open access journal that charges a fee in the social science and humanities is, are you crazy? Okay, so what might be the rationale for going away? We have a simple and clear rationale in the sense that the Research Network 1989 is about East and West, and I am, as a PhD and a postdoc, I've been to Poland, and more interestingly, I've been to Siberia. And in Siberia, I was an academical doc. This is this science town outside Novosibirsk, where you have the Siberia branch of the Russian Academy of Science, and you also have the Novosibirsk State University, which by Russian standards is relatively good. Now you go there, you sit there, you might have internet connections, but try and get access to anything. Impossible, right? And even when they did have more or less free access, i.e. JSTOR, I think charged like $200 a year or whatever for access to JSTOR, it wasn't of any use because somehow the internet was connected in such a way that if you try to download something from JSTOR, and these files are bigger because of the way they've been scanned and turned into document never arrives. You can spend your whole day in the library. It might have gotten better since I've been there, but I'm assuming the major configuration has changed. So there's a clear rationale in terms of reaching an audience, yeah, that we can only reach a large part of our audience. And then we thought about this business model. What do we do about the fee? How can we justify the fee? What could we do to do it? And anyway, I mean, this reaction, are you crazy? In the second instance comes, for example, with the argument, and that is true. Do you know any social science and humanities research that has a budget that could actually pay the publication fee? Are they going to pay privately? Okay, then you've got a problem. Now, we might assume that in the open world of open access publishing over the next 2-3 years, this will get better, and maybe it will get better as more research funders are willing to pay this, or maybe more universities, there are now some universities that say that will fund this. But it is big money, and anyway, the research funders tend to fund more the natural sciences and social sciences. So we thought, what could we do with it? And the idea we've come up with for the moment is, what about if the journal got something like an endowment? And the endowment meant that you could, so to speak, send in your manuscript for peer review on a need-blind basis. I.e., you didn't have to think about whether you could afford a publication charge or not, or whether you had somebody who would pay it or not, or what, you could simply send it in. The idea isn't very original, it's simply corralled from the policy of the Ivy League of charging a tuition fee, but doing a need-blind admission. That's all that it is. But what's appealing about the idea in terms of open access publishing, of course, is that the Ivy League has a definite reputation for quality. And that the quality allows them to also charge a substantial fee. So one of the things that we thought is, if we do a publication fee, we don't want to charge $200 or something, yeah? And then do it in our living room. If we do it, we charge a substantial publication fee that really covers the cost that would need to be so high to also cover the cost we can't afford to pay. Therefore, we would need to get the quality of the journal. But then we can do this, we can have sort of a need-blind peer review and a business model that has an endowment and somehow replenishes itself through the publication charges that do get paid. With the additional twist that if somebody gets accepted for publication, we would write a letter that they could take to the institution and funder and say that we expect them to pay the fee, not the author. So this is under discussion. If you have any ideas, feedback, interesting thoughts for me, also think this is a crazy idea, please let me know. It's an experiment where I'm trying to see where this goes and what we can do it. And of course, I'm hoping that in some way we get it started, and then when we do the study on open access publishing, we can go and observe whether it works, right? And how this would need to be changed. And we do have, and let me close with that, we did, when we went to Brussels and talked to the European Commission, one of the things they did say to us was, the proposal you have is fine and nice, but you're talking mainly STM and market. What you need to do is you need to talk social science and humanities, you need to tell us what's possible there. And you also need to look at some sort of solutions that aren't completely commercial. So this would be one such possible solution. And it's at least clear from that conversation that, say, at the European level, at the level of the European Commission, they are interested. They do want to know if the social sciences and humanities system would work, and if so, what kind of models might be possible. This was one we had with an endowment. Another one I'd be happy to discuss is actually with the state, for example, should in this case come in a much stronger role. Okay. Okay. Now, this was, so to speak, the prologue that I put in. Now I wanted to go back to a bit more about open access in the social sciences and humanities. And I want to do this in the first instance by putting forward the hypothesis that in structural terms, transition to e-science, e-social science, digital technology, internet, and so on, there isn't actually a whole lot of difference between STM and SSH, that it doesn't amount to much. And that there's no way you can actually, over the long term, say that the cultures of SSH mean that it's all going to be different. Now, this is also an argument within, say, science and technology studies, or the wider world of scholarship on science and technology, in the sense that something that has been relatively popular over the past 10 years is to investigate academic tribes, certain disciplinary cultures, and to emphasize that cultures somehow make people different, make the academic tribes different, the disciplines different from each other. And of course, this argument is also these days used in politics to justify why for discipline X, Y needs to be different. What I've done is I've gone through what I think are innovations in scholarly communication and have systematically tried to match something that happens in STM with something in SSH. It exists as a paper and as a publication, to kind of bring forward the argument that if you look at it in a structural sense, there isn't altogether that much difference. There is certainly a difference in the kind of details that it works, how it works, but on the whole, there isn't. And that when you look at these innovations in scholarly communication, that are also somehow connected with open access. I'm going to just run very quickly through them a bit, because I don't want to spend my whole hour talking. So the first one, I was looking in terms of disciplinary repositories and electronic distributions. CERN and Archive and these physicists are always seen as a special case. But if you look at it, the Social Science Research Network, or for that matter something called REPIC, Research Papers in Economics, pretty much have the same function, pretty much do it the same kind of way. Actually, some of the services of the SSRA are better than Archive. And we have this morning, it was you, right? SSRA already has Humanities now, so I don't see the difference. Another thing that has happened is in terms of online literature awareness tools. So this is on the internet, enhancing access to the literature that you see by somehow giving you some sort of tools for its evaluation, reviews, or so on. So living reviews, concept that was mentioned already, was developed in physics, but has been used in political science and for that matter here in the end. There's another concept that you have, something called Faculty of Thousands, which brings together a large number of faculty that comment on peer-reviewed published literature on a weekly ongoing basis. It's a service you can subscribe to. But if you look at the concept of that service, Faculty of Thousands, you can extend it to other disciplines and so on. Innovations in peer review that have to do with the internet, you get more inclusive scholarly communication, and you have that. I put out two journals. We have that in the natural sciences as well as in the social sciences. So the issue here, for example, is that instead of doing a so-called blind peer review, single blind or double blind peer review, they do it the other way around. They do an open signed peer review. This is to enhance the quality of the peer review internally by making the peer reviewers responsible for what they write and making the peer reviewers visible to the authors and or the subscribers of the journal. And to some extent, we know for atmospheric chemistry and physics that this has worked wonders. They are, in terms of journal impact factor, on top of the league. So in their field, they're number one journal, even though they're new, they're e-only, and a few other things, open access, of course. Then, three other themes that I've come across is about reducing barriers and costs while accelerating the increasing publication rates, or simply new modes of scholarly publishing, trying to create a different kind of platform, or doing open access in such a way that you integrate it into an open digital library. And in each instance, you find, wherever you are, you find instances of this. So it doesn't matter whether you're dealing with STM or SSH. Okay, now to the five reasons, and then I'll talk about five roads for open access in SSH. A coda. When I talk about open access, I don't necessarily talk about open access in the purest kind of way all the time. So I would also call something open access for the time being that substantially increases access. And you can have different ways of doing this, and it doesn't necessarily always mean that it needs to be free to all readers on the internet. I'll come back to that in a minute with the example of JSTOR. Okay, but reasons for enhancing access or for creating open access in the social sciences. The five that I've come up with, I think, are fairly important, is obviously that it facilitates the advancement of knowledge claims if you post them out open on the internet for all to see and to react and to respond to, that you get a more globally exclusive scholarly communication, and that the social sciences in particular and humanities system accounts for the rise of comparative and transnational research. As an example, I can give this up on the project I'm involved in, the Research Network 1989. We can only ever really collaborate transnationally, and of course what we're planning to is to work towards genuine funded transnational research collaborations. If things are accessible, publication and data, and they can go back and forth, and there are no barriers there, or they're at least as low as possible. Increasing the public visibility, enhancing the impact for teaching and learning, and opening up innovative space for So these are also earlier examples that I've shown, for example, increasing public visibility and enhancing impact for teaching and learning. You might be aware of this open courseware project at MIT, co-sponsored by Hewlett Packard, which basically puts all the teaching materials of MIT on the internet available for other people to use, to download for self-study, but presumably also for teaching at other institutions if they would care to use it. And of course, you can enhance this if the underlying text, the underlying bibliography of that course also becomes available on the internet. You just need to click yourself through, and there you have your reader, right, on my desktop, and that's it. And the administrative space for publishing, for example, the two peer review examples I just gave. Okay, five roles to open access in the social sciences and humanities. The example I just gave you, where we were thinking about starting an open access journal or giving preference and submission to open access journals, I found that through the directory of open access journals and other services, there's now a way in which you can sort of type in which journal you are thinking of publishing, and then it sort of lists your alternatives that you could publish in, if they're open access, and sort of then gives you a link where you can check whether you might be interested in this. The second one, obviously, is to deposit your paper. The third one, to assert your rights. Not and retain the copyright. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. Another idea or something that I've come across is the question of ensuring lifelong access for university alumni through electronic libraries. Now, this is a very interesting and also very curious kind of thing. I've gone around with this in some countries and sort of asked, and it obviously depends on the contracts you have. So one of the things that I've learned is that on the continent in Europe, a lot of institutions have very restrictive access contracts with the publishers, which goes all the way to that you can access certain kinds of digital content only through specific desktops. Yeah? Sort of name the desktops with a certain IP address sitting in a certain library will give you access to JSTOR. And nowhere else can you do this. And these kinds of contracts seem to be quite widespread. Then you get another kind of version, say in the UK, but maybe also spreading on the continent. Now in Germany, you also have these national licenses. Yeah, when you have a national license, then the higher education institutions per se get some sort of access. In Germany now, they've actually also extended it. So as a private person, I can select three or four that I want out of the 300 or whatever, not a lot, but something. And if you're lucky, then you even have a sort of authentication and passwords that meant while I was in Siberia, I was still affiliated with a UK university, so I could use the internet to log into my UK university and I had access to everything. Apart from the problem of not really being able to download it because of certain speeds. In principle, this kind of works. But there's a way you could go further, and I found that I think by now three American universities that have a deal with their alumni association that means that all the alumni of the university can, against paying a fee of, I think, $80 or something per year, have access to the full electronic library of the institution they graduated from. Now, this isn't full open access in the sense of free to read it, but if such a solution spreads, you get a large number of people, i.e., everybody who's ever been to a higher education institution, that can access stuff. It's a considerable extension. And then the last one is to spread this out on free access in low income countries. There are several initiatives. Scenario, Aurora, and so on, which are health, agriculture, and so on related. But you could also name JSTOR, for example. JSTOR obviously has scales on which it charges. And when I inquired after Siberia, what they were charging was very, very little, so the access for them was basically free. And I've heard back from JSTOR that there are actually countries or places where they will sell the access to free. So that they won't charge. And they do this by having a differential charging model, a different model, whereby the larger institutions pay more and the richer countries you pay more and you do this. This is not a pure solution, but it does something. Okay, moving, where am I in terms of time? Oops.
Let's see this one here. About 20 to 1, so I guess
quick.
If you could do it in 5 minutes, it would be great.
Okay. Then I'll just highlight a few things. When we talk about green world open access, I think what I want to highlight is what the peer project is bringing and which might be spreading, i.e. some sort of assisted or maybe even paid for archiving that doesn't actually rely any longer on the authors to do it themselves. I.e. some sort of solution that means that the publishers get involved and that there is a feed, a pipeline from the publishers into the repositories relatively directly. This can be the so-called stage two manuscript, i.e. the final peer review draft, or it could, as in the Max Planck-Springer case, already be the final published version. Then we can also look, of course, what kind of rights come with this, whether, for example, you don't just get the PDF, but you can put it up in XML or whatever, or ASCII. So questions about how this is evolving, and on the other hand, with all open access, the question of where this is going at the moment with other models than author pays being explored. And I'll just skip talking about this. There's one more, so to speak, one more avenue I want to go down and explore a bit to kind of try and pull together what I've talked about. And this is by looking at the problem of access in terms of the scholarly communication cycle. Now, for purposes of simplification, I would say the scholarly communication cycle, as far as publishing is concerned, consists of the registration of a knowledge claim. This is, you know, date and timestamp, if you so like. The certification, that's the peer review. Is it good enough? Is it? What can we do with it? The dissemination, that it goes out. Archiving, that it becomes available in the long term. And some sort of navigation services so that you can access to it. Okay, and there's, I think, something happening in terms of the digital economy that means that this is going to change in the future. Now, the publishers, of course, would like to think, and particularly the traditional publishers, like, for example, participate in the peer project, that what the journal does is registration, certification, dissemination, archiving on the publisher's website, and of course they build some sort of navigation services to it, or they do this collaborative, link resolvers, or cross-referencing, yeah? These kinds of services. Okay, but I think that if you look at the digital economy and ask yourself what is going on there, and look at how the repositories are coming in, I think you can see that having a journal as the registrar of knowledge claims was maybe for a certain time a good idea, but principally it never was, and today again it isn't. Principally it isn't, because if you submit to a journal, you do get a date and timestamp if you select on the submission, but because your manuscript might get rejected. You don't know whether you're actually going to have that knowledge claim. If the manuscript just sort of comes back to you, it's quite dubious. If you yourself put that manuscript into a repository, SSRN, archive, replic, your own institutional repository also gets a date and timestamp. And that stays. And in terms of registering your knowledge claims and registering priority, or making sure that somebody doesn't steal your ideas, much safer. No journal can ever do that for you. Not the way they're structured. If you look at certification and dissemination, of course, in the traditional publishing model, and this is what the publishers would like to keep, this has been conjoined. And the famous precedent, of course, is all the books, Philip Tramp's of the Royal Society, 1665, which did the peer review, right? Printed the thing and disseminated it. Okay. Now, the publishers these days would like to say that they're indispensable for the peer review, for certification, and I would probably say that they can, at least in principle, probably be the best institution to organize it. However, do they really need to do the dissemination? Think of the Springer-Max-Planck deal. Yeah? In the Springer-Max-Planck deal, Springer is the certification agency. But because their published version goes out to the Max Planck Society, they are no longer necessary for dissemination. That function, in principle, they do not need to have any longer. And my guess is that it's going to go away. So the publisher, between registration and dissemination, will be responsible for certification. Archiving with the publisher's website, I know they have invested a lot, and this is also partly, particularly why the fight is so hard, as far as I can tell. Yeah, so they put all these millions into Springer, Link, Science Direct, and what have you. Yeah, sunk investments, huge sunk investments, and the hope, of course, to make money on the whole back catalog, to become the world's archives for their journals. However, if you think about it, so to speak, historically, and the function of the libraries, my guess is it's not really here to stay. And if you look at certain kinds of projects, also the way the national libraries are gearing up, the way they need to invent projects in case journals fail, or publishers fail, or so on, I'm doubtful that this is going to stay with publishers in the long term. And then the navigation services would be publishers again, but it depends on how you do it. I don't have time to go into it in detail, but the idea here is, if you were to move to a system of publishing where you do not grant exclusive copyright, but just non-exclusive licenses to publish, then you can also sever the links, so to speak, between the publishing and the navigation services, and because what is published becomes freely available, and the navigation services that can build on it can be competitive again, and it doesn't have to be the same people. There's a very nice example for it, if you want to check this out. You all know about, I assume, about PubMed Central. And there's a nice little service out of Dresden in Germany, which is called gopubmed.com, which is an overlay service that builds on this PubMed Central and provides this kind of navigation to the literature through multiple ways of evaluating authors, institutions, the literature, and so on. You can search that overlay service to get hold of the basic. And it's a very interesting way of possibly building competitive navigation service. So to sum up, what I'm suggesting here is that when you look at open access in the context of the large economy and the way digital technologies are emerging, that the publishers have quite a lot of change ahead of them, and that